The story is the point. The story is the point, and that's why we listen to the entire thing. Here in this story, more so even than the dialogue that Jesus has with Nicodemus, and then last week, the one we heard, the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, we have a series of short scenes that highlight conflict and then tension between the characters. So much so that as the story unfolds, we wonder whether the one to whom such a healing has come will not, in fact, come to a very bad end. Such is not the case, thankfully, but there's clearly a sense of foreboding when the whole time, or at least probably about halfway through, the listener begins to think, hold on a minute, shouldn't we all be celebrating what's happened here? What's going on? Many of us might know about or have read Rabbi Harold Kushner's famous book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It's an important book. We also all have complaints, just read the Psalms, about when good things happen to bad people. The reverse of that. That shouldn't happen, right? Less commented on is what this story notices. When good things happen for oppressed people, how those with power often do not react positively, for reasons this story explores. More than the other two readings, we're being let in on the historical conflict that gives rise to John's gospel in the first place. You see, each of the gospels is trying to do two things at once. And I'm sure we all know this intuitively. Trying to be faithful to the Jesus tradition, if you will. Jesus, his historical ministry, his death, and what happened next, which the gospel writers called resurrection. And the second thing, apply those stories in an encouraging, healing, teaching way to the particular challenges faced by the small communities of faith to which these gospels were originally written. In other words, the gospels are a sacrament of the word. They, excuse the language that comes from the New Age, they channel Jesus and Jesus' spirit, capital S, available at particular times and places outside of what had originally happened. It's one of the reasons we place the reading of the gospel in the center of the community. Wherever the gospels are read, we believe Christ is present. Just as we believe Christ is present in the bath and in the sip and nibble that you'll have in a few minutes. Best we can tell, John was probably originally written for a small series of communities throughout the Roman Empire, probably around 90, maybe 95. These small communities were being severely persecuted by synagogue leaders. Now you remember there were synagogues throughout wherever the diaspora of Jews happened in the Roman Empire. And these synagogues, especially after the destruction of Jerusalem, came to be dominated by the Pharisaical tradition, the way of looking at the law that the Pharisees taught. This was the beginning of the final split, then, between the synagogue, made up mostly of ethnic Jews and some converts from paganism, and Jesus followers, the church, made up of a mix of ethnic Jews and converts from paganism. In other words, this conflict wasn't ethnic, it was religious. Now, a bit about the Pharisees. They often get a bad rap, but we must understand that they were a reforming group of Jewish religious leaders, scholars, who believed in social justice and the opportunity for all Jews and those who converted to Judaism to be full members of the community. They were, as I said at our study on Wednesday, seeking to democratize Judaism around a common code of conduct. Ultimately, Jesus isn't opposed to the democratization of Judaism. It's just that from his perspective, their circle of inclusion is too narrow and therefore still oppressive towards certain people. Too narrow a vision will always result in the privileging of certain holy days, like the Sabbath, or certain holy practices, the way you clean your hands, say. And these will come at the expense of people. And so Jesus' job is a broader, wider task. He's democratizing the one God of Judaism as the God for every nation, for Jews and Gentiles, for Pharisees, and unclean, blind beggars. And this is what's infuriating to the Pharisees. In his day, he's doing the equivalent of what infuriates so many on the right wing today, letting into fellowship those they consider morally unclean. And in his day, he's doing what infuriates so many on the left today, seeking the conversion of the elites, people like Nicodemus. I sometimes think that Jesus would feel equally at home in a radical setting on the left, say liberation theology or Black Lives Matter, and he would mingle with the Ku Klux Klan meeting. Sounds horribly controversial, but he would be at both. His message, his movement, then, is the true, the absolute democratization. There is, as the story will demonstrate, only one boundary, and that is Jesus. There is only one core sin, rejecting the good that Jesus does. And so, in a day and age of new boundaries springing up, talk of new walls, of groups on the left and the right seeking to demonize certain other groups, what might it mean to embrace what Jesus is doing here, and so find ourselves actually with him, living from his vision of God? Now, we don't have time, as I've said in this series, to fully analyze these stories. That would be to disrupt the story as story, if you will. The story is the point, and the point is the story. What I can share with you is the one way I identified while listening to it, while reading it, one way the Spirit spoke to the Pharisee in me, one way that I want to change. And maybe you'll have your own way. As he walked along, Jesus saw a man blind from birth. It's not an image of a man he sees, not the sheer fact of his existence, the fact that he's taking up space on the side of the road as a beggar, but rather that he is blind from birth. He sees the condition that has defined and shaped this man's life more than any other. And Jesus' seeing is a noticing that already is a humanizing. Of course, Jesus sees more than his condition. He sees what's possible in the same way that Samuel sees David and sees what's possible. He sees this man as God's man. But, now let's get this right, this further seeing begins with the former, with noticing that which has defined and enslaved him. The disciples, as usual, provide the foil. Frustratingly, I find myself doing what they do too often. Encouragingly, I note that they're still called disciples. They still get to be followers of Jesus, even when they get it wrong. Jesus still loves them. and I trust still loves me, still loves us. They don't see the man, but the social problem he stands for. Who sinned? This man or his parents that he was born blind? They want an abstract answer that will allow them to continue to avoid the actual person whose obvious plight makes them feel uncomfortable. They want to, probably they don't mean to, but they are in fact dehumanizing him. So they don't have to identify with him. So they don't have to help him. It was around 6 a.m., the second Sunday in January 2016, when two cop cars rolled up right outside my bedroom window. I didn't see the cars, but I heard the police radios when they opened the doors. So, it's an odd hour, right, for cop cars to be rolling up. So for a split second, I had that awful feeling that there was going to be a knock on my door to be followed by a bit of horrible news about one of my children. But the bell was tolling, but it wasn't tolling for me. It was tolling for my neighbor. And I heard the exchange. I regret to inform you that your son passed away this morning. And then my neighbor's anguished, no. With those words, the abstract phrase, BC's opioid crisis, took on a human face. And I've shared this story, I think, once before here in a sermon. My neighbor's son passed away. My questions, my judgments about those who use or abuse drugs, their parents, and even those who supply the drugs melted away as I saw the son's face in his father's cry. Jesus' answer to the disciples' abstract, you know, get this problem out of my face so I can continue on my merry way question, changes everything. Neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. We shouldn't hear this answer as a kind of divine setup, as if the only reason this man was born blind was for this moment. But rather, we should understand this man, indeed every human being, my neighbor's son, not in terms of what they've done or what's been done to them, both good and bad, but in terms of God. God sees each person, as our first reading clearly says, truly sees them, sees us this morning, sees you, sees me. And the sole aim of God is not to reject, as the wording of our first reading puts it, but to illumine, to bring life. That each of us move ourselves from non-seeing, from blindness, toward the type of seeing that Jesus here demonstrates. A seeing that notices. A seeing that restores dignity. You did notice, right, that Jesus involves the blind man in his healing. Reform movements that introduce new levels of bureaucracy are going to be important in every nation, in every town and village. The Pharisees were very, very important for the formation of Judaism. We, too, as a church, have our own codes of conduct. We've got one posted in our Yale room to help remind each council member about what it looks like to have a civil conversation about important and sometimes divisive topics. But what Jesus does here, and for all time, is to remind us that all reforms, all religious rules, are meant to serve the healing of all. Jesus is where the heart and the code of conduct meet in the illumined face of each person before us, in every act of attention, and in each possibility of forgiveness for each act of inattention. I had a good friend, a mentor, Eugene Peterson, former professor and pastor. This man helped create, well, he actually did create the Message translation. Whenever he'd come to Regent College for his morning classes, he'd come 15 minutes early so that any appointment that he had, 15 minutes earlier than any appointment he had, so that he could be interrupted by someone who might want to talk with him, or so that he might be able to truly notice the people he was passing on his way to his office door. He gave himself the space to notice others and not be completely focused on the tasks at hand. We experience a culture and a society in which we rush by each other. This Lent, why not practice fresh noticing? Why not break out of your familiar box and talk to some new people? Why not dare to strike up a conversation with a stranger? I'm still learning to do this. I'm still learning to remember that my life really is about people and not tasks. Slowly, with God's help, we can learn this Jesus way together. And when we do, we'll find to our amazement that much healing happens in us and in others. Amen.